This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoen talking with Lisa Friedman, who covers climate change, the environment for the New York Times. And in about 10 minutes or so, we'll be talking about the caravan of migrants who have been journeying through Mexico towards the U.S. border. Lisa, let me go back to Scott Pruitt. And is there, again, I guess I'm asking you to get inside his head, but I'm thinking about first-class airfare. Also, his 24/7 security detail. He wanted a bulletproof SUV. He wanted apparently a bulletproof desk. I didn't know such a thing existed. He wanted a private jet. There's also a soundproof booth that has been installed in his office. Why does he need so much security? Now he and others say that he has experienced death threats, but is there any way to know that?
Sure. Let's talk about the security first. I mean, what EPA has said is that Scott Pruitt has faced an unprecedented amount of death threats against him, against his family. And that, they say, is the reason for the size of the security detail, which we understand to be about 21 people, at least three times the size of other administrators. I'm told Gina McCarthy had about six people, not 24/7. And they have pointed to a number of comments that the Inspector General has made. Patrick Sullivan, the EPA's Inspector General for Investigations, has pointed to four or five times the number of threats against Pruitt than against Gina McCarthy. But still, you know, this raises other questions. My colleague at the Associated Press, Michael Biersiger, did a terrific story over the weekend in which he pointed out that the administrator, when he has paid for his flights himself, has flown coach. But when he flies as a part of the government, he has flown first class, and the reasoning he's given for that is because of the need for security. So obviously that raises a good number of questions about why security only requires first class travel when it is government travel and not personal.
You and some of your other colleagues at the New York Times wrote that and I'm quoting here, at least five officials at the EPA, four of them high ranking, were reassigned or demoted or requested new jobs in the past year after they raised concerns about the spending and management of the agency's administrator, Scott Pruitt. Were these whistleblowers or these people, and who did they go to complain about the money that was being spent?
That's right. In some cases, whistleblowers, in some cases, they are people who put up resistance and were eventually moved within the agency or had a growing number of problems within the agency. We're told that it was very difficult to push back against what the administrator and those around him wanted to have by way of security or travel. And those who did found themselves moved into jobs where they had less of a say in how money was spent and less interaction with the administrator. And in one case moved off of the position of leading the security detail.
Conversely, there were two members, a senior counsel, I think, and a scheduling director, got increased, pretty sizable increased salaries, even bypassing the White House. Can you explain what happened here?
Sure. I mean, if you listen to Administrator Pruitt in his interview with Fox News, he has said that was not his doing. That his staff decided that two people that he brought with him from Oklahoma should get such sizable raises. Other outlets have reported that Scott Pruitt indeed was the decision maker on those cases. I don't have that reporting myself, but mm-hmm. I have talked to people who find it unusual that anyone else would be deciding that the two staffers would get such large raises, if not for Administrator mm-hmm. Pruitt.
And it seems like maybe defying is too strong a word, but not
and going around the
going
normal
around.
Course of how exactly right. of how raises are given and how people are hired in the agency, going around the White House decision not to give such raises by putting them in a different stream of funding.
And then there's a question about this room that he rented for $50 a night. It's a little bit complicated, and I'm not sure how important it is. But is that also a factor, at least coming from the critics of the EPA administrator?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, you know, that's I think that goes straight to Senator Kennedy's chucklehead comment. You know, and you've had Lindsey Graham say yesterday that, you know, he doesn't know anyone who could get a room on Capitol Hill for that amount. You know, this is something that the White House says that it's looking at. And I think it remains to be seen what else comes out about this.
Pruitt has also held meetings with industry representatives. Does he also meet with environmental groups? Or has
yes,
he?
Yes, but far fewer. You know, since, you know, we've had initial stories that we've had initial stories about
You okay?
Sorry, I'm so sorry. We're talking about the I just had a small brain.
We're talking about who he has met with since he's been an administrator.
Okay. Yeah, I mean, when we did our initial stories last year regarding his calendar, showing that he was meeting with one industry representative after another, I think it was we had his calendars up to, I want to say, May, and he had met with one large group at one time, one meeting of environmental activists and others. There may have been one other. Since then, you know, they've made a point of including environmental groups here and there. But overwhelmingly, if you look at his calendars, which we now have through August of last year, it is overwhelmingly meetings with industry.
Well, Lisa Friedman, thank you so much for joining us today on Radio Times, getting us up to speed on all this news about EPA Administrator Scott Pruitt.
Thanks so much.
You're welcome. Lisa Friedman, and she covers climate change for The Times. Let me just add a couple of tweets before we move on. One said, Pruitt is the personification of Republican environmental policy. A tweet from Max, following the money, who in Congress is connected to lobbyists or their stock portfolio that's connected to businesses, corporations, Wall Street, ? Well, now we want to focus on another story that has been in the news, the caravan of migrants from Central America who've been traveling together to the U.S.-Mexico border to ask for asylum. This has happened in years past, and this year it caught the attention of President Trump, who said they posed a threat to the country and asked for the National Guard to be sent to the area to secure the border. Delphine Schrank spent a week with the caravan and is the Mexico and Central America correspondent for Reuters and joins us on Radio Times. Delphine Schrank, nice to have you with us on the show.
Thank you so much for having me.
Also with us is Maria Sacchetti, and she covers immigration for The Washington Post. Maria, nice to have you with us on Radio Times as well.
Good morning.
And to our listeners, lines open at 1-888-477-9499 as we shift gears here. Also, you can contact us through radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Delphine, let me begin with you with just a couple of questions about this caravan. First of all, where is the caravan today?
It's sort of split into three, I would say. So about 150 men from the caravan, which at its peak had numbered over 1,000, 1,500, about 150 men had sort of made their way to Mexico City, to the capital. about another 600, according to the organizers, many of them women, had made their way to the city of Puebla, which is about an hour south of here, and today they're going to make their way to Mexico City. The rest have sort of peeled off on their own. So the end of the caravan's journey, they decided sometime last week, for a variety of reasons I'm sure we'll get into, they decided they would end it at Mexico City instead of at the U.S. border.
Do they see that as a failure on their part?
You know, not necessarily, because the point of the caravan was to provide protection to migrants. As you mentioned at the top of the program, these caravans happen every year. The intention of them is to allow Central American migrants to gather in southern Mexico to travel together the long route. Yes, ideally to the U.S. border, because many of them want to go to the U.S., not necessarily to the U.S. border, because not everyone wants to cross into the U.S. Some Central American migrants who are leaving Guatemala, El Salvador, and Honduras are happy to stay in Mexico. A lot of the people I talked to said that. So this is, many of them will go on to the U.S. border, but it's not so much a failure as just a change of plans, I think, is the way they see it.
And let me pick up on that. And it is said before, the people coming from Honduras and Guatemala and these other countries in Central America, what are they fleeing from?
They are fleeing a number of things. A repetitive pattern of people telling me economic conditions were appalling, extraordinary levels of violence. I counted well over a dozen people who face direct lethal threat from gangs, either to themselves or to their children. And a lot of people fled within 24 hours of a final threat, whether from Honduras or El Salvador, mainly. In addition to that, there were a lot of Hondurans in this year's caravan. And part of what touched off Donald Trump's ire, I think, was that he heard that over 1,000 people were in this caravan. This is the first time caravan has been this big. It's four times the size of last year. And this year there were over 800 Hondurans. A lot of that seems very much related to the political unrest in the country that followed contested elections last November. And several members of the caravan I spoke with were in the protests, suffered a sense of sort of crackdowns in their houses afterwards. There's a congresswoman on the run. So a lot of the political impact from that and the economic consequences from the political unrest seems to have had a major effect on Honduras. So that's another push factor.
We have all seen pictures of the caravan as it started, I think, that towards the end of March. And I always wonder, how do children make, however long this journey is so far, how do they make it through the terrain and obviously the difficult conditions?
That's such a great question. That's what I was asking them too.
Really?
This year, again, there were at least 300 children, which is the reason that the director of the organization that organized this caravan, he said the reason that they decided to stop at Mexico City, I'll just say before I get to your question, was because they had so many children this year on the caravan. And instead of the pressure from the United States, that's what made him decide to end at the Capitol. Because, to answer your question, the way that people travel through Mexico on this caravan or on their own is very similar. They basically have to walk or take a bus from their own country. And to get to southern Mexico through Guatemala, people who are fleeing Salvador and Honduras with children, many of them walked for long, long distances or took buses. And then in Mexico, they walk if they don't have money, or they take buses, or they jump on top of a freight train, which is so dangerous for migrants that its nickname is El Tren de la Muerte, the train of death. And I saw a little child who was traveling with his mother, a solo mother of two. She showed me his foot, and his foot was flaking and black between the toes. He'd been wearing flip-flops, but they were very, very poor. They didn't have any money on them. And that was the result of having walked for hours and hours. So it's been a difficult situation for them.
Oh, I can only imagine. Maria, let me get you in on the conversation. And the president called for the National Guard to be sent to the area. Now, of course, it's really governors who make those kinds of decisions. Are we seeing the National Guard or more of them making it to the U.S.-Mexico border?
So I'm in D.C. and not on the U.S. Not on the border, but that was what the president had said would happen, and that is clearly his intention. I think California is still reviewing it, mm-hmm. but some governors have offered to send smaller contingents, so they're expected to go.
And this is not the first time a president has called for the National Guard to go to the U.S.-Mexico border. President Obama did it. President Bush did it.
That's right. And in 1997, an American who was working, he was herding livestock, and he was shot and killed. And so people take this very seriously. Border Patrol agents are actually specially trained. They know about the countries people are coming from. They know who's coming. They know about the smuggling networks, including the ones who are just kind of guarding the border. So some folks are concerned that the people coming from places like Arkansas or even Arizona, you know, might not be as familiar with the specialized work that the Border Patrol does. But at the same time, some people are welcoming this additional support because the numbers have been increasing.
The numbers of people, migrants coming over the U.S.-Mexico border?
Correct.
And why is that?
Well, there's varying reasons. I mean, these are sophisticated smuggling networks. And people have seen over the past year that, you know, recall that Trump took office saying he was going to end catch and release. And in last year, his then Homeland Security Secretary, John Kelly, said it was over. And, of course, on Friday, we got another memo saying it was going to be ended. So there's a lot of confusion here in the United States. You can imagine the confusion in the different countries in Latin America where people work for perhaps $5 a day, or there's extreme violence, or you know, and poverty, or just an individual family crisis can trigger someone to decide to leave everything behind and go. And remember, crossing the border is a very dangerous experience as well. So they take very serious personal risks in doing that, and they can pay a lot of money to do it. So it's a business, and the business is still going.
We're almost up at a break. Your catch and release is, can you explain that for our listeners, Maria?
Certainly. So, I mean, it has varied quite a bit. And sort of like the term sanctuary, it really depends on how you define it. It used to mean you catch someone at the border and you release them perhaps back into Mexico. But now the numbers coming are from Central America, and they can't be returned, of course, to Mexico. Right. Immediately. And so what it has come to mean is you catch someone here in the United States and you release them pending an immigration hearing, but because there's just not enough detention bed space, and in many cases they don't show up for that hearing.
And they're released,
they don't know about it.
They're released in the United States then?
Yes, they're released in the United States.
Well, let's take that short break and then we'll get back to our conversation. That's Maria Sacchetti. She covers immigration for The Washington Post. Delphine Schrank also joins us as well from Mexico City. And she is the Mexico and Central America correspondent for Reuters. And she was telling us about the caravan. And she spent a week with the caravan, interviewing members of the caravan, trying to make their way to the U.S.-Mexico border. But as she described to us, not all will make it. 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. You can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times to join the conversation. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoane talking with Maria Sacchetti and Delphine Schrank about the migrants, the caravan in Mexico, also talking about immigration as well. Let me play something that President Trump said last week. He was part of a roundtable discussion on tax reform during his visit to the White Sulphur Springs, West Virginia. But he tossed his script and said this about immigration.
They're not putting their good ones. And remember my opening remarks at Trump Tower when I opened. Everybody said, oh, he was so tough. And I used the word rape. And yesterday it came out where this journey coming up, women are raped at levels that nobody's ever seen before. They don't want to mention that.
Devin, let me turn back to you, and you describe certainly the women who were part of this caravan and previous caravans or groups that have tried to cross into the U.S. Are they Are they the victims of rape on their way to the U.S. border? I'm trying to figure out what you think the president was referring to.
I assume that he seems to be alluding to the caravan itself. My interpretation of what he was saying, he'd been attacking the caravan itself. And it's not clear if he was saying that within the caravan people were getting raped, or if that just happens to be the case, that people wouldn't get raped on their way. What I can tell you from the caravan, it's exactly the contrary. Mm-hmm. I met plenty of women there who were there for their own safety, because it is, you know, the trek north, a 2,000-mile trek from the southern Mexico border and from their own country, never mind that, to the U.S. border involves tremendous dangers to anyone who takes the route. Robbery, extortion, assault. There are levels of rape of women who are traveling on their own because they're very vulnerable when they're in these situations. But in a caravan, the whole point of it is if they travel as a collective, by bus, by foot, and they're sleeping out together outside under the stars or wherever they can find in a town square in a little shelter, they're protected. I didn't see one single instance of people getting, you know, individually harm. To the contrary, they were building friendships and they felt much more safe.
Maria, let me go back to you and go back to the numbers of border crossings. I was looking at some statistics over the weekend, and I think, at least going back to the year 2000, more than, I think, 1.5 million people were apprehended at the border. It has had some ups and downs since then, but mostly down since then. What do we know about, and we have a tweet from Pete saying that there are seasonal rises, illegal border crossing at record lows. What do we know about these border crossings?
Well, it's definitely cyclical, but over if you step back and you look at it beyond Trump, they've been plunging. I mean, they're at much, much lower levels now than they've been in decades. And that's not just because of Trump. In fact, there was after he took office last year, there was a precipitous drop, a big drop, and that was probably attributed to his very tough rhetoric on border security and immigration. But they've been declining for years. I mean, birth rates in Mexico have been falling. Economic prospects there are better than they were before. And the numbers, people just aren't coming in the numbers they used to. And security has risen, and there are greater consequences. You're more likely to be detained, or if you've crossed before and been deported, you're more likely to be prosecuted criminally for that. And as you know, cartels and others have played a greater role in the smuggling networks, it's become a lot more dangerous to cross. Mm-hmm. Like the mom-and-pop smuggling operations just aren't nearly as powerful if they you know, have even exist at all in many places.
Of course, President Obama was in office for 8 years and President Trump for a little more than one. But, Maria, I know critics of President Obama called him the deporter-in-chief.
And he was in some years. I mean, he did deport a lot of people. Still, again, kind of pulling back from that, there's 11 million undocumented immigrants in this country. And I think at his peak, it was something around 4% of those were deported. Mm-hmm. And so, yes, he did deport a lot of people. And I think in this country, there's this divide between you know, people who say, well, if you're here illegally, then you should be deported, and others who say, it's a lot more complicated than that, and people are here filling jobs. We need them, and they've been here a long time, and they should be allowed to stay.
Duffy, let me go back to you, and even picking up on what Maria was talking about the numbers of the drop-off and on the numbers of people trying to come to the U.S., does that square with what you see in Central America?
Yeah, but I think there's a distinction to be made, and Maria, feel free to correct me if I'm wrong. I think the number of Mexicans who are trying to cross the United States has gone down significantly. And since Trump took office, or just before, we were seeing a downward trend of all border crossing. But we're now seeing an uptick again to numbers that align with pre-Trump months of Central Americans trying to cross, certainly of Hondurans and Guatemalans, and I believe Salvadorans. Now, what I can say from speaking to the individuals who are part of that group, or at least are the ones that I was talking with in the past week, is, you know, there seems to be a lot of a sense that many of these people were doing it for political posturing, or that they had some notion of how they were going to cross the northern border. What I saw from talking to a lot of people, or heard, they aren't that knowledgeable about policy on the U.S. side. They might have heard, they've certainly heard Trump's rhetoric, but the push factors for them were much more severe, and they hadn't heard of DACA. The ones that I talked to hadn't heard of DACA, they hadn't heard of catch and release. I mean, these are all terms that are bandied about very, very openly in the U.S., but from the Central American side, from the northern triangle of these three countries that we're mainly talking about, where homicide rates are among the highest in the world, where poverty is extreme, malnutrition is bad. I mean, a whole host of reasons that consume people's lives, they're not thinking so much about the ins and outs of the immigration debate on the U.S. side. That's what I was seeing. So I didn't really see much of people really thinking about the business aspects and being really strategic about this. They just wanted to go.
But Delphine, you describe at least this caravan, such as it's called. Most of the people are not going to make their way to the U.S.-Mexico border. So what are they going to do? Are they going to go back home? Or are they going to try to stay in Mexico?
A lot will try to stay in Mexico, and a lot will actually try to make it to the U.S. border, but they'll do it however they can. And I would ask people, how are you going to do that? You know that the northern frontier is very difficult, and some said, well, I'll cross the desert. Some said, oh, I'll find a way. Many of them have relatives in various parts of the U.S., so they're going to try to make their way there, or they have a friend there. Others who want to stay in Mexico, same thing. They know people in Mexico, or they think that they just might have better chances here for their lives. So it really varies depending on the individual. Those who want to stay in Mexico for their safety, there are plenty of places in Mexico where they can go and try and find a better life than in their home country.
Maria, let me go to something that you wrote recently in the Washington Post. ICE raids meatpacking plant in rural Tennessee. Mm-hmm. 97 immigrants arrested. Apparently one of the largest, or maybe the largest, raid in a decade. What happened?
Well, so last year, ICE Director Thomas Holman had said he would order ICE agents to quadruple or even, a higher number their efforts to conduct workplace inspections and raids, similar to what happened in the Bush era. This particular group happened to be mostly from Mexico, which is, I'm not sure if Delphine heard me correctly, but that's what I was referring to with the lower birth rates in Mexico, that there were fewer people coming from Mexico. So that is true, right? But still, overall, if you look globally, even though there are lots of people coming from Central America, it's still much, much smaller than it was in the 90s and in the early 2000s. Yeah, and so I think that's kind of when they talk about a crisis on the border, I guess I look at it in that context. It's
compared
really,
to what? You're saying compared to what?
Like a million a year, you would see, a million, people would be returned. I mean, it was much, much larger in the surge of the 1990s when the economy was booming. So there were many more people trying to cross the border. But speaking about what happened in Tennessee, I mean, it's the first sign we're seeing that the Trump administration is serious about bringing back the big immigration raids that we saw during the Bush administration. And there's a lot of debate about whether they're very effective at helping deport people. I mean, you look at Obama, he really didn't detain people that way. He worked with the jails. He conducted things differently. He worked through technology to identify undocumented immigrants who had been arrested for crimes. And he managed to deport more people than Bush did. Mm. So, but these raids can be terrifying. They're a big symbol, I think, to immigrants. They're afraid to make them afraid to go to work, makes them afraid to be in a building, and it really can upend an entire community.
And in this particular raid, where will these people be sent?
So that's another interesting thing about immigration. Unlike the police and the sheriffs and every other law enforcement agency in the United States, they don't have to tell you who they arrest. They say it's to protect the immigrant's privacy, but that also means that their relatives don't immediately know where they're going necessarily. Definitely the public doesn't, so it's very difficult to monitor. So they could be in Louisiana. They could be in Texas. They could be in Mexico. I don't know.
Right. And do you know why this particular meat processing plant in Tennessee?
Well, I mean, apparently they'd had issues before and they'd been under investigation for some time. As often has been the case in the past with immigration raids, there's been complaints. There are concerns about how the workers were treated. I guess they weren't paid overtime. They worked long hours. There was some concern about, you know, the way things were being, they were paid in cash. There was a bank, and they were concerned that the owners or the managers were withdrawing large sums of money every single week to pay the workers, and there's concerns about tax evasion and things like that. So the aim of the investigation is a criminal one, that there's concerns about tax fraud and tax evasion, but they named in the search warrant affidavit, they named a handful of managers who we'll have to see if what the latest is on their charges. But as is common in these immigration raids, many more immigrants were affected. Ah. So they were arrested for civil immigration violations. Some have for criminal immigration violations, and that's where you see it. If you're looking at pure numbers, these raids tend to get far more workers than managers.
Delphine, let me go back to you. And we know about the relationship, if I can call it that, between the president of Mexico and the president of the United States. How does that complicate people trying to come to this country?
Well, I think Mexican authorities certainly in the last week were put in a pretty difficult situation where they were under great threat, they were under great pressure, I should say, obviously directly by President Trump, who kept railing about this caravan and threatening to pull out of NAFTA, which has been under negotiation and remains in a very tense situation. So at that level, it meant that Mexican authorities stalled the caravan and began processing the migrants that were on it and giving them travel permits. But it effectively, to trickle down to the ground level, meant that there was more scrutiny of the migrants. So in that sense, I think it makes people more wary about moving north, because Mexican authorities, though rhetorically the officials may not seem to be cooperating with U.S. officials, they kind of have been forced to. So I think that's how it complicates it.
And Maria, it seemed as if the president conflated these migrants coming to the United States with DACA. He has also said that the DACA is no more, although I read some reporting over the weekend that the Justice Department has approved something like 50,000 DACA applications. Is there any way to understand what is going on with DACA?
Well, so it is. It's a Homeland Security and
Homeland Security.
And it's
sorry.
Continuing.
Yes.
Yeah. There. No. That's fine. It's confusing. The yes. So there in January, a federal judge in California halted Trump administration's plans to start phasing out DACA in March. So everyone had hoped, including Republicans, including the president, that Congress would hammer out a deal on DACA in exchange for some pretty severe restrictions on immigration and in border security and the wall and things like that. So that never materialized, of course. But the courts intervened and ordered the Trump administration to keep renewing DACA until they could sort out, you know, whether he had ended it properly. A federal court in New York followed up with that as well and issued its own injunction.
Hmm.
So the Supreme Court declined to take it up. So that could take years to unfold.
So in the meantime, for the DACA recipients, they're in kind of a limbo, or
they can renew their permits.
They can, so they can. It's as if DACA still exists, if I can put it that way.
Right, but now they're without a net, right? So if they end up losing the lawsuit, then it could end up being phased out.
Well, we are going to end on that note. Maria Sacchetti, thank you very much for joining us today on Radio Times.
Thank you.
And she covers immigration for the Washington Post. Delphine Trang, thank you for joining us as well.
Thanks so much.
You're welcome. She's the Mexico and Central America correspondent for Reuters. She joined us from Mexico City. Maria Sacchetti joining us from Washington, D.C. I should add that Delphine Schrank spent a week with the caravan. These are the migrants trying to make their way to the U.S.-Mexico border. Go to WHYY.org/Radio Times, and you can find out more about the program. You can download a podcast of the show, find us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter, sign up for our newsletter. Al Banks, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, the show produced by Debbie Builder, John Ahrens, and Trine Nuri, today with Susan Greenbaum. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. Thank you for joining us.